For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, this is Alan. This episode is sponsored by Manscaped. You can go to manscaped.com, get 20% off your total purchase order when you use promo code PORCHTALK, all one word, at checkout. That's PORCHTALK, all one word. All right, so they have several different packages going on right now, such as the Platinum, which will really break you into everything that Manscaped does with the Beard Hedger 4.0, the Lawnmower 2.0, the Weed Whacker, the chafing underwear, the ball deodorant. I mean, they've got a little bit of everything. If you haven't given Manscaped a shot, I do highly recommend them. I've truly enjoyed each of the products they've sent me, most comfortable underwear I've ever used, and the best beard hedger I've ever owned. So if you have not given them a try, ladies, look out for that brother or your man in your life. Go to manscaped.com, use promo code PORCHTALK, get 20% off your total purchase order. That's Porch Talk, all one word. All right, let's get to the show. Welcome you to Porch Talk. This is your host, Alan. We're in Columbus, Mississippi at Munson Brothers, home of craft beer and great pizza. So I've got Trish Evans here with me. I met her some time ago at the Columbus Arts Council. She was coming in and giving Salem and Shane the scoop on some of the historical facts about some of the buildings, and I thought we would talk a little bit about Columbus today. Trish, how you doing?
Hey, good, thanks. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so Trish, tell me how you got so interested in digging up these old bones in Columbus.
I grew up here, and storytelling is something that is an old art form in the South, and especially in my family. And I grew up playing in most of the old homes in this town, and some of them had people living in them, and some of them did not. And we used to hang out and climb all over everything. I've been on top of every building in town, whether I was supposed to or not. And I've been in, around, and on top of, and inside most of the houses in Columbus and a lot of the other older buildings. And so it just drove a curiosity to know more about them. And since I love research, I was always in the courthouse and digging around in old documents and in the library. And so that's kind of where that came from.
Yeah, and something that we'll get into a little bit later, like just through some of your research, it was extra to Columbus, like maybe going down to Macon to find some information on some of the things, because maybe Columbus didn't want to talk about it.
Well, yeah. a murder of a fellow in about 1982.
Yeah.
Started down in Macon, ended up here, going back and forth, and I ended up finding documentation that led to looking into federal court documents. By finding what was not in Macon, mm-hmm. and which led to looking into newspapers and literally just flipping page after page after page in the old archives up at the Dispatch.
Yeah. So I wanted to go ahead and plug your TikTok just for listeners. I mean, if you wanted to know more about Columbus, you have this lady just walking the streets and stopping at buildings and telling a little bit about the history of that building.
Yeah, about people, and this Mississippi girl, I don't know, 462 or something like that. I don't know, it's got a number after it. I don't pay attention to it. But you can edit that in if you want. But mostly I'm doing research about people and places and stories. And yeah. I mean, even some of the old ghost stories that people have told. And if you believe, then...
And just for Columbus, like some of the interesting things, like even the Art Council, that was the original, was it the Alabama Theater?
So the Arts Council in the back where you go in and they have the upstairs room. Mm-hmm. That was the Dixie Theater.
Dixie, okay.
And it was the original Princess Theater.
Oh.
Yeah, that's where it was originally. And then at some point, I think it's P.W. Mayer owned it, who also owned one of the newspapers in town. So there were, at that point, two newspapers. And then there were eventually three theaters, and which grew to four. And so there was, that became the Dixie, and then there was the Princess, and then there was the Varsity. Hmm. And so the cinema and plays and things were have been an integral part of this community. The really interesting thing is that the Oddfellows building, which was like, you know, where Gontai it used to be.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So the Oddfellows building burned, and the story is it was a bank in there, and so like they were running out with the bank, like a lady ran in and got the bank books, literally to get the bank books out, or otherwise people's records would have been lost, right?
She did a service.
Yeah, she did, and so did some other people. And anyways, there's pictures of giant ladders and people just, it was a bucket brigade. Well, that fire, of course, spread out, and then because it was so high, and I believe that building, the Rosenzweig building, was three stories at that time, and I think Oddfellows was four or five stories. It was taller than it
is. Oh,
wow. And so the fire, as the cinders were blowing and spreading, they were afraid that it was going to get all the way over to the cotton mill, which is
Trotter.
Yeah, and then so, you know, there were people on top of all those roofs trying to put out the fire. And so it did have some damage. And so when they were renovating that space upstairs for the theater that that the Columbus Arts Council is using now, that theater space, in between the walls, they found old, I think it's Tom Mix posters.
Huh.
Which are the old cowboy movies, I think that's the bridging time between talkies and
Silent
movies. So it's just after. But they're the originals.
Wow.
Yeah, so Salem has now had those framed and put up in the foyer when you go upstairs to that theater space.
Well, that makes total sense now. And just along with, like, Columbus Art Council partnering with the Princess Theater now with showing old films.
Uh-huh.
Like on Halloween,
yeah, yeah.
We did some old showings.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's what inspired it now.
Possibly. I think so. And you know, the downstairs area when I was a kid was a dime store.
Oh, wow.
And so we used to go in there and buy our bags of popcorn. And then they had the little bins where you could buy the penny candy or the like you could go buy Jacks, you know, a bag of Jacks for like, I don't know, like 50 cents or whatever. So, you know, that whole building, it's interesting to see how it's all changed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember just Columbus from when I was a kid, just 20 years ago. I mean, I remember where the original Walmart was.
And yeah.
It's moved now. And
I remember when the original Walmart was houses and farms.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like thinking 45 toward the Air Force Base, I was like,
yeah,
none of that was Columbus. That was just outside of Columbus.
Uh-huh. That was county.
And now look at where it's going.
Yep.
So I wanted to, does it start like just historically with like what you're very proficient in? Would it go back to where we're at with the Trotter now and being the cotton gin, like during that era?
Oh, well, but you know, that's from the cotton gin came about later. It's not even that, it wasn't even that old. I mean, it burned in the 30s, I believe. And it came about, and then there was like, you know, this parking lot across the street, that was where they took the cotton, I think that was where they stored the lint and the linseed.
Huh.
And then that burned. And so there's, you know, we've had fires over and over and over.
Yes,
but a
like,
lot of this stuff came about, the big production of cotton didn't come along until after the Civil War, mainly because of rail. Because up until the Civil War and a little after, most of our traffic went down to Mobile by river, and it depended on the river flooding. Because you couldn't take a riverboat much further north of Columbus. You couldn't go all the way up to Aberdeen unless the river was at flood stage.
Huh.
Because there's too many sandbars and turns and whatever. And so they depended on the flood seasons to take the cotton to market.
Okay.
And so a lot of the operations weren't that huge, because if you think about it, how many bales of cotton could fit on a boat?
Right.
And so, and those boats would be down to the waterline. You know, if you had 500 bales of cotton or 400, 250, whatever. And so, and a lot of it was, you know, after the Civil War, there was no labor, and then they had to go to, you know, they used sharecroppers and tenant farmers in the production. And because of during the Civil War, and this is kind of just a, you know, a rapid fire short synopsis that's not so short. I'm oversimplifying it, but essentially, during the Civil War, England was one of our largest consumers of our cotton, and New England, but the mills in England needed cotton, and we were too busy fighting a war, so there was no cotton for the, and there were, you know, blockades, and so our cotton couldn't get out of the South. So they had to start looking for other sources of cotton. And so that was India.
Oh, wow.
And so India and Egypt and et cetera, et cetera. So the demand for cotton, for our cotton, went down. And so the cotton market changed. And so many things changed. So they had to change how they did business, because they didn't have the labor supply of enslaved labor. They didn't, you know, they didn't have the market to go to that they had had to go to. So things had to shift and change, and they had to get more cost efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of what, where all of that, where a lot of that infrastructure suddenly got built, was to meet that market change.
Okay. So, I mean, we know the Trotter today, as we just rented it out to do a boxing event. It's been used for music events, different events. At the right time, that used to be the gin, right?
Well, the building, that whole, the back of that, all of that.
Okay, from like, what, the other side of Catfish Alley to Main Street?
Not quite. So like the bank building, it would have butted up to the back of that bank building.
Okay.
So it would have taken up a large portion of that. And some of the overflow, like, would be here, some of the associated industries. And warehouses. You had to have huge warehouses. And one of the warehouses that burned was, you know, that parking lot that's across the street from Catfish Alley?
Yes.
That was, there was a big warehouse there. And that burned. And matter of fact, some firemen were killed in that fire, in a big fire there.
Were these fires at that time, were they on purpose, or it was just...
No, so cotton's highly flammable. I mean, static electricity would cause the lint to ignite. I mean, it was very dangerous working in these mills. And they were also still using coal oil in a lot of places, and kerosene lanterns. They think possibly, one of the theories I've heard was the night watchman, that somebody left a kerosene lantern lit, and the lint, you know, it just caused enough of a combustion that it just caused a chain reaction. And that actually burned for days.
Jeez.
Days. So.
Yeah, it seems like, just from our last conversation before, it seems like there's not many places in downtown Columbus that we know now that haven't caught fire.
Yeah. And it's really interesting that fire was a huge problem. A huge problem. Mm-hmm. And it was a great fear. And that we actually are, you know, the antique pumper that's in the... over by the firehouse on 7th.
Oh, yeah.
7th. I think that's actually the very first fire engine in Columbus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What about with the Antebellum Homes and the event that's upcoming for these downtown homes? What's some of the histories of those places?
Let's see. There's the Whitfield Home, which is also called Snowden. Snowden is on 3rd North. And apparently Jefferson Davis was friends with the Whitfields. Whitfield was one of the governors of Mississippi and a very well-to-do man. he actually bought the house across the street that's now called Baskerville Manor. It used to be called Hamilton Hall, and that was built for his sons. That was a wedding present for his son. So the two families lived across the street from each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Baskerville Manor, actually the back building, it used to be a stagecoach stop.
Oh.
And the horses, they come down Military Road, Andrew Jackson Highway, and trade out horses. Well, that went out of style, essentially, I guess, and with the train travel and river travel. So the home, that piece of property, the front part of the property, did not have an actual standing building. And that's why he bought that and built his son that beautiful brick home there.
Yeah.
And so the house across the street, of course, is kind of got a concave. It's got an ellipse that you could drive a carriage in back in the day, and it had a great big overhanging balcony. So Jefferson Davis was visiting for some reason, and Columbus was the capital of the Confederacy at one point for a hot minute. And
so it seemed like that swapped around a lot. It was Natchez at some point.
A lot of it was. How close Grant and Sheridan and Sherman and a few other generals were on their tail. But anyways, Davis was in his... Well, they found out he was there, the people of the town. He was so popular, they came down and they... By torchlight, and they all stood there, and he went out in his nightshirt. Well, and you think about it, a nightshirt at that time, we laugh when we go, yeah, well, you know, he put on his nightshirt and he's gone to bed. Actually, no, a man's shirt that he wore was long, and it would double as their nightshirt. Because when you travel, you by horseback, you can only carry so much.
Mm-hmm.
So they would put collars on those shirts and a tie.
Oh, yeah.
And so your nightshirt was just something a shirt you wore. You slept in it, you dressed it up when you went out, and...
Yeah, I remember when we were, this is elementary school, I went to South Lamar, they would bring us over, and I always liked that, and I didn't know how accurate some of the people were portraying it, but I like going through those homes and like seeing the people kind of dressed up, and whatever time period that would have been, I guess it really depends on what they're trying to tell.
Well, and some of it probably is, I mean, it's over-dramatized, like, the average person wouldn't have had all that heavy furniture, all those tchotchkes in there, the ceramic and the fancy candelabras and all. They wouldn't have had those at all the time.
Mm-hmm.
One or two houses maybe, but most of them, those homes were lived in and very sooty. And if they didn't have a detached kitchen that they would cook in their dining rooms, on those big fireplaces. So you wouldn't have all that stuff. It would get broken. It would get, knocked over. So a lot of the houses have period items in them that would be appropriate, and they may have been owned at one time by the people in those homes. But, you have to take it with a grain of salt they probably were more austere homes than what you perceive.
Yeah.
Because life wasn't easy then. I mean, if you think about it, or wear a hoop skirt and crinolines and all that stuff and go out to the outhouse or use a chamber pot.
A whole process.
Yeah, it's a whole process. So, I don't think it was as pretty and clean as...
It's made out to be.
Yeah, I mean, they're beautiful homes, and I think they're done well, and I think the time is expressed well, but I don't know that it's actually that accurate to daily life in those homes.
Yeah, I'm just trying to put myself in that mindset, like, what a day in life look like that? I mean, I imagine it had to be hard, because we have it so easy now with technology.
Yeah, and even if they had enslaved people in their homes... There was still, it would have been horrible to have been that person, the enslaved person, because they did the least of the savory stuff. Their lives were horrible.
Yeah. That kind of reminds me, like, of where Alec is now, his stepfather. The
old slave quarters.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in the old cabins.
Yeah.
And those are kind of generous compared to some I've seen. But when, you know, it's this, it wasn't glamorous. Yeah. Let's just put it that way.
All right. Tell me about Sandfield.
Sandfield is the oldest African-American cemetery in Columbus, Mississippi. It was actually established, the piece of land was owned by a guy named Aiken. I believe that's right. Irvin. And he had this vision that it should be as elaborate and a twin almost to Friendship Cemetery, because it was designed to be that way. And it was supposed to be twice the size of what it is now. So now it's about 10.4 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be about 20 acres. And various reasons, pieces of it were sold off or didn't come to fruition. Well, now the businesses are encroaching. But so he sold the property to the city. In the 1850s, I think 1854. Don't hold me to that because I can't remember exactly. But he sold it to the city, and that became the African American cemetery, because there wasn't what they would have called the colored cemetery at that time. We had Friendship Cemetery, which was all white, and that was owned by the it's owned by the city now, but it was the International Order of Odd Fellows. So that's why the front part of Friendship is concentric rings that hang over each other, because it's the Odd Fellows symbol.
Yeah. Starkville has an Odd Fellows too.
So Sandfield was supposed to be like a spoken hub. So it was supposed to have a center round area that would have had like a giant, essentially a bandstand, and which was very common. People had picnics and celebrations in cemeteries back in the day. It wasn't this morose place that we have it, you know, that we think of them today.
Right.
And so they had, you know, those like spokes off of that, and so they could have brought the funeral carriages in to deliver the dead on wagons, essentially hearses and wagons of the time. And they were supposed to be wide enough to have like two horses or two mules wide. And you kind of can see that when you go out there, especially in the hot, dry months when the grass has kind of died back and you can actually see the paths. But it's full. And a lot of people don't realize that because there's so many headstones that are now gone or broken and knocked over. But then there's a lot of people in there who never had a headstone, for various reasons. A lot of it's poverty.
Yeah.
I believe the oldest headstone in there is an enslaved woman, and her name was Mary. And people have attributed to her name as Mary Baskerville, but that's not her last name. She actually was a servant for a Colonel Charles Baskerville, and he's buried over in Friendship.
Oh, wow.
And he was very prominent in the Episcopal Church here at St. Paul's. He was one of the largest people who donated to build the Episcopal Church back in the day. But we think she's the first person that's buried out there, and if not the first, she's the earliest headstone out there.
Oh, wow!
And she's buried at the back of Isaac Washington's family plot, which is interesting because he was a school teacher here, and no one's really sure if she's really buried there or if her headstone was just erected there.
That's crazy. There's blues markers all over the state of Mississippi. Columbus happens to be home to one, Catfish Alley, but it's not in the right place.
Well, it's not really on Catfish Alley. It's on the corner It's in front of, used to be a white attorney's office, and before that it was an A&P. It was a corner market. And it's across from the white Episcopal Church in town.
Yeah.
But that's very typical. Many of the blues markers are not in front of black-owned businesses or even the actual site where they actually belong. So, for example, down in the Delta, mm-hmm. in Carroll County, Mississippi John Hurt was a very prominent musician who played at the Newport Blues Festival, and he recorded a whole bunch of songs in the 60s.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
60s and 70s, and he's quite well renowned in the in a lot of the what I would call country blues. You know, some people call it folk blues era. Well, his sign is up against the country in front of you can't even read the part that's about John Hurt himself, because it doesn't face the road. It faces the country, and it's in front of a store that he never played at. They make it sound like he played at the Valley Grocery Store. Never would have, never could have, because he was of the wrong color and would have been run off. So it's just, why it's there is beyond me. It's not in Avalon. It's not near the place where his actual home was down, you know. It's not near Teoc, where he's buried. It's about a mile, I would say half mile to a mile from where he's buried.
Yeah, it's like even with the Robert Johnson, with that marker, like marking the crossroad and the story of that.
And which crossroad? There's
exactly. It's not even at the right crossroad.
Which one is the right crossroads?
That's another good question.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of people made a lot of money off of Robert Johnson, with the except for his descendants.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with John Hurt. A lot of people make a lot of money off of Mississippi John Hurt. The family doesn't even own the images. They cannot sell even, like, an image of him.
Mm-hmm. And I think about, which I've been able to interview some of these blues musicians, like Jimmy Duck. He was he was fairly reserved when it came to playing on the record. He didn't mind talking about the how his parents founded the Blue Front Cafe and the history of it. But when it came to, give me a little taste of the Bentonian blues, fairly reserved, because he had been ripped off by so many journalists and reporters. And we think about mixed feelings on Fat Possum Records.
Mm-hmm.
If it weren't for Fat Possum, would we be celebrating Cedric Burnside and some of these people if someone hadn't gone and recorded them? And then, well, now we say, well, his descendants and even himself didn't make any money practically off of that. Mm-mm. So, yeah, he's known now, but two, taken advantage of. Catfish Alley, Columbus, is there a true history of the blues here in this town?
Well, you know, the song Catfish Alley, depends on who you want to attribute the lyrics to. But we know the tune is nothing original. That tune has been used by a bunch of different songs.
Mm-hmm.
And Catfish Alley's not the first version of it. But that was kind of the nature of the blues. They took a lot of songs, like, you know, was it Death Letter Blues? That's got a whole bunch of different verses and a whole different bunch of different versions to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, chicken or the egg? The music was first, the lyrics came about, but, you know, the more interesting thing is what it's based on, and the fact that Catfish Alley was, you know, a place in my childhood where it was black owned businesses. That's where the African American doctors were and dentists. who had been in that area for, you know, a long time. And there were businesses down, you know, downstairs on the ground level. There was, you know, restaurants, and it was a thriving community. And as a kid, we used to go there and buy our catfish. You know, you'd go, I'd go get my catfish plates and carry them home on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put out these big braziers. Now, I knew that I was not supposed to go to Catfish Alley in the evenings because there'd be drinking and music and stuff going on, and, you know,
yeah,
kids just, you just didn't go into adult spaces. So it was not about race. It was just about, it was an adult space.
Right. Yeah, I get to thinking about a juke joint and, like, what makes a juke joint. And it's kind of what I think about when I hear stories about Catfish Alley at night.
Yeah. And it was, you know, but there were several different vibrant black communities in Columbus. It was made up of lots of them. Sandfield was homeowners, and a lot of people worked on the railroad or worked in the garment factories, or because there was a Sansevieria factory and some stuff like that behind there, and you know, different jobs that, you know, they were building community.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had over by Union Academy, north side of town, which was probably the second oldest black community in Columbus, maybe the third oldest, and that was a vibrant community, and it had the Queen City Hotel, it had grocery stores, it had hairdressers, it had barbershops, it had, you know, it had its own, had little corner grocery stores. So that was a very vibrant community. And those people that lived in that community, a lot of them worked on the railroad, and they worked in the brickyard. So they worked for Puckett's, mm-hmm. what's now the Puckett Brickyard. And so, and then a lot of the people who lived down here in Burns Bottom, a lot of them worked at the cotton mill.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the businesses downtown, and then in between, and in the south side of town, when you go across the railroad track, it was the same thing. They worked in, they were draymen, they worked in the livery stables, they were oilmen on, you know, for the different factories, and night watchmen, and, you know, they had jobs where a lot of them walked to work.
Mm-hmm. And now Burns Bottom is not even recognizable to what it used to be.
It doesn't exist. It's gone. And, you know, and there's a lot of mixed feeling about that, that, you know, oh, well, a lot of it was empty, and, you know, it floods. I'm like, it still floods. I don't care.
Right. But you know, we have a soccer field now.
Yeah, but now they want to build, there's a big thing down here that says they're going to build mixed condos down here, mixed size condos, mixed community. Well, I thought we took everything out of there because it flooded. So what's the story?
Mm-hmm.
Are we doing urban renewal? Or, you know, it's like there were a lot of people who lived there for generations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're gone. You know, and then the, I always talk about it. You know, we talk about historic preservation. Wasn't that historic? Burns Bottom was very historic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, the only thing that we do now is little festivals that we throw maybe once a month to preserve it. And I had no idea that it was called Burns Bottom or Frog Bottom.
It was named
or,
after a house. Burns is the, that was a antebellum home up here. And it was for sale for next to nothing. And nobody wanted it.
Is that the one right there? Is it gone now?
It's gone now.
Okay.
They
tore
it down.
I didn't know if it
down.
Was that one right by Zachary's.
No, it
was.
Been
around that?
No. It was.
Oh.
It was just right over here on the hill.
Oh, okay.
That way. Sorry.
Okay.
And it was torn down because they had it for sale for nothing. I mean, it would have taken hundreds of thousands to fix it.
Yeah.
But here are all these people around here screaming historic preservation, and it got torn down.
Didn't want to preserve that.
Nobody wanted to preserve it. Nobody wanted to put their money where their mouth is. And so, you know, we have all these historic preservation groups in the community, and, you know, they it's almost as if it gives, you know, it kind of makes, it's like people go, well, we want to do this, we want to do that. I'm like, well, do it then. Quit talking about it and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are very few people who are actually doing it. I wish it was different. And I know there's the whole, well, we don't have any money. I'm like, I don't have any money either. And I went out and wrote a grant with the organization I work with, and we're trying to preserve the history of a place.
A lot of that's focused on Sandfield at this moment, right?
Well, that and collecting all the locations of African American churches and cemeteries in Lowndes County. It's a three count. We've got three counties at the beginning of it. And created an ArcGIS, which is a mapping system where individuals can add eventually stories, pictures, histories. But you can locate where actual African American cemeteries are, because they're being lost. I mean, Sandfield's been encroached well upon.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just like last we spoke, I mean, even the grave sites of some of the bluesmen throughout Mississippi, like my mind goes to Crawford.
Mm-hmm. Big Joe Williams, he's out in the middle of a cow field, literally.
Yeah. And even where his blues marker is not in the right place.
Well, yeah, but part of it's because his, I don't know, and maybe the descendants who owned the property didn't want the marker. I don't know the story of his marker, but it's out on a highway, on an alternate highway that no one uses.
Right. Crawford is, you know, it's becoming like Sugarloaf or a lot of these towns just outside of the Delta, where it's there's no industry, it's forgotten.
It's blown away. It's drying up and blown away. You know, and so there's not even directions how to get to Big Joe Williams' grave.
Right.
It's a country road, but he deserves to be known.
Absolutely. I wanted to talk a little bit about the lynchings. There's a lot more that happened here than what's reported.
Mm-hmm. We actually had, we were second in the state. One of the things we can be so not proud of. We're second to Hinds County for the largest number of lynchings between Reconstruction and just after the Civil Rights era.
Hola.
So we have some lynchings that are from as early as 1880s up until late 1930s, early 1940s, and possibly beyond. But those are the ones that I've definitely isolated through inquest records at the courthouse and news articles, and then interviews with descendants.
Yeah, I wanted to focus on one specific story. It would have been down on the south side by the railroad track.
Mm-hmm.
Can you mind telling that story?
Billy Calhoun?
Mm-hmm.
So Billy Calhoun was a flagman for the railroad, and as a flagman, he had a home. The railroad provided him a house.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty nice. If you go down, you go right past, you go right across below, right below where the Marble Works, the old Marble Works building is.
Okay.
That's 4th Street. And you're going south, like you're going to the Friendship Cemetery. That was called St. John Street at the time. But it's 4th and about 9th. Which is like the next avenue just past the parallels the railroad track. And there's a pretty little yellow Victorian house there. And that was built by the railroad for railroad employees. And so Billy lived there with his wife and his daughter and his stepchildren. His wife had 2 children from a previous marriage. And he had an older son as well. So they're all living there. Mm-hmm. And he got in an argument with his coworkers over him working at the as a flagman at one of the favored crossings of the railroad. And so the guy he got in an argument with had gone to Billy's boss and said, you know, black man shouldn't have such a nice job and have his house provided for him. And this white guy was not happy because he was his job was just working on the rails and running a crew. And so he kept complaining, and his boss was like, I'm not going to do anything. He's actually probably one of the best employees I've ever had. So the next week, somebody jumped Billy and cut his throat and dumped his body over below what's now Carrier Chapel. At that time, there was a chair factory in that area, a furniture factory, and his body was found by his stepson and 2 other men who were their neighbors.
They were looking for him.
And were looking for him. An inquest was held. It was determined that he was murdered, possibly for his pay, by persons or person or persons unknown. So,
yeah, friendly city, right?
Yeah. And his family has always said the descendants have always said that he was lynched. Now, lynching doesn't mean hanging.
Right.
Always. Okay. You know, just for clarity's sake, a lot of people think that means you have to be hung to be.
Right. It can be. You can be beat to death.
Another guy was beat to death for almost the same thing. Possibly was the same person.
Jeez.
A few years later, I got to remember his name. The guy's name, who was killed, I think is Will Matthews. And his last name's Matthews. He lived right across the street from Palmer Home. And that was an orphanage then. It was called Palmer Orphanage. And he also worked on the railroad in a prize position. And they know who killed him. And I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head. There was an inquest held. He was investigated. But what happened was these men came to the guy's house. He'd been in an argument with him at work. He tried to go to the op boss and say that he wanted his job, he wanted his house, blah, blah, blah. And they had their argument. And on late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, these men came to the door, knocked on the door. His wife wouldn't open the door. He tried to go out the back. The men came, heard him going out the back, went around back, shot him and killed him.
Jeez.
And an inquest was held. The one guy was identified. He was identified as the one who killed him. He never confessed. And the man's wife, the man that was killed, his wife, so I never saw his face. I couldn't tell.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine. Well, patrons are beginning to come in. I wanted to ask three more questions and we'll wrap this up.
Okay.
Of the organizations, I don't know if you would like to share who you're working with, but is there ways that people could give or get more information?
Yes, I work for the Mount Zion Memorial Fund. We are MountZionMemorialFund.org or .com. You can look us up either way. .com is the easiest one. We are currently running a GoFundMe to rescue the last existing true juke joint, first generation juke joint, owned by Alonzo Chapman down in Glen Allen, Mississippi, and it's currently owned by Ollie Morganfield, who is Muddy Waters' nephew.
How about that?
And we're,
well, at least it stayed in the family.
Yeah, and so we're trying to raise enough funds to put it on the National Historic Register so that we can get some grants and help him
restore.
Do a proper restoration, but he's been doing everything he can, slowly but surely.
Yeah.
And they're still playing music there.
Awesome. Question two, it'll when we have time to get back together, I wanted to focus a whole episode on just the blues, but
okay.
With Columbus and the blues, we talked a little bit about Catfish Alley, but are there any more like memorable figures who may have passed through here during that time?
You put me on the spot. I mean, there were, actually.
Yeah.
Now that if I could think of them, that's another story. You know, this Columbus has always been on the map, and there were quite a few places that blues artists would actually come and play. They were, you know, they played at Queen City. They also played at white venues here in town. So, there were some really great soul bands and all kinds of early black music came through town. There was a place across the street, just over there off of Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Chisholm Trail. And my folks, I mean, it was like a supper club. And my folks would go and listen to Big Joe Williams and there was a guy, Big Bull Moose. I can't think of his name, the musician's name. But there were a lot of first-rate blues artists that would come through Columbus and play gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And they would play in multiple places. Like, they would play, like, they played the early seating at, like, maybe the Chisholm Trail. And then they'd play from 6 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd pack up, and then they'd go to maybe the Queen City or someplace else.
Yeah.
And they would play, you know, they would play like the Silver Spur, maybe from 11 to 1 in the morning.
Doing two shows.
Yeah, and that was, but that was the life of a musician back then.
Oh yeah, I know. One guy who's kind of helping me map out Black Prairie music. Those guys, when it was getting started, it was a little bit different than it was in Mississippi. They would travel by train. And so they would, from Mobile up to Black Prairie, and then over into Meridian and into the Delta, and that was how their music traveled. So it's kind of exciting to see how, just even the blues, like just how music traveled and how it influenced. And you have rock and roll, and from Mississippi blues to Chicago blues to it being whitewashed down in Texas.
The Kansas blues, Kansas City blues, yeah.
So it's always kind of interesting to track. Last question. What was favorite memories growing up here in Columbus? Like you mentioned, like getting on every rooftop and.
Well, my favorite thing to do, honest to goodness, two things. The rivers always played a big part in our lives here. We were kids. We used to go down. I would follow the bigger kids down. Mostly it was David and Mark Evans and Rice Glover and, you know, some of the bigger kids that were in the neighborhood. We all lived on Third. I mean, all of it was like straight stretch. And we'd go straight down to the bottom of Third to the boat launch and then cut right. And there was a big hill. And there was a rope swing, and we would swing out on that rope swing hours and hours, and then you'd have to climb up the clay bank, and that was, you know, that took more exercise than the rope.
Oh yeah.
And then the other thing was we used to go down past Carrier Chapel. There used to be a railroad bridge, the trestle, and we'd walk out on the trestle and jump out in the river. It's a wonder we don't have tetanus. It's a wonder we didn't jump on a. You know, some submerged. God only knows how we survived.
We used to jump off bridges here in town, and then the one over on the east side, close to John's Deli. Years later, after we had been jumped off that bridge there a million times. Some old timer was like, "Don't jump off that bridge because they threw the old railroad ties."
Or down below there.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, "We could have been skewered."
Or stuck, you know, get trapped down there. So, like I said, I always wonder, you know, the other thing is, you know, we were never allowed to go. Nice kids didn't go to Bob's, which was across the river, the old river bridge. And so my folks forbade us from going to Bob's. But they never said you can't go to Bob's. What they said was you're not allowed to drive across the bridge. Well, that's a challenge. So we used to pirogue across.
You can't drive.
I can't drive. I'm not driving. I didn't drive across that bridge. I didn't go across that bridge. My mama would say, "Don't you go across that bridge." Yes, ma'am. I'm not going across that bridge.
No problem.
I just piroged across and climbed up the bank and went up to.
Went up to Bob's.
Not like there was anything there we wanted anyways.
That was the thrill of it, right?
Yeah, it was just breaking the rules. Hamburgers and french fries. And, you know, it was just. But we weren't allowed to cross the bridge.
Well, cool. Well, Trish, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Some more, but then.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.